The assignment three little glitch got fixed, so those are accessible on the website now. What happened there? Escape and avoidance. Definitions here. Escape. We define escape as saying escape happens when you get away from an aversive stimulus that is in progress. Avoidance is when you get away, or perhaps a better way to say prevent, the delivery of an aversive stimulus before it happens. So escape, so if you, you know, got up and left the class right now, that would be escape. If you never came today, that would be avoidance, right? So avoidance occurs when you never actually get the aversive thing because you've done something to prevent it. Escape happens when it's in progress and, boop, you get out of it. Now, standard way that this is studied in behavioral psychology is utilizing what are called shuttle boxes. Some of the earliest people to use this technique consistently were Solomon and Wynn. So we'll just take an example from one of their early papers on this. They work with dogs. This is back in the day when you still worked with dogs in psychology. They had a chamber that was made, a box, big enough for a dog, the dogs they were using. And basically it's a rectangular box with either had a little line painted down the middle of the box or a short barrier. Not a big barrier. It's not like a big fence the dog had to leap over, but it was just there to demarcate the middle line. Now, the floor of the box was a metal mesh that they could send an electric shock through. Okay, so they can, there's the aversive thing, so electric foot shock. On both sides of the box, they had light bulbs. These are going to act as the discriminative stimuli. Okay, so that's basically a shuttle box. You could use speakers for tones or little flags come up, whatever. But it has to be something there on both sides of the box to act as a discriminative stimuli, the ability to deliver something aversive, and a clear demarcation between one side and the other side of the box. Now, the way they set it up, and you can do it different ways, but the way Solomon Wynn set it up was when a light turned off, 8 seconds later, a shock would be delivered on that side. So if the light on side one turns off, 8 seconds later, there would be an electric shock delivered on side one. No electric shock being delivered on side two. Okay? So if the dog is sitting there on side one, light turns off, bzz, it's getting shocked. If it jumps over to the other side of the box, over to side two, or steps over, walks over, whatever, we say that is escape. It has escaped the aversive stimulus. It's escaped the shock. If, after repeated trials, the dog looks up and goes, uh-oh, light's turned off, I'm a very smart dog, 8 seconds from now, a shock will be delivered, I'm going to leave now. If it leaves and goes over to the other side, before it gets the shock, that's avoidance. Okay? So, now, in terms of operant conditioning theory, it's really easy to explain escape. Nobody really argues about how we explain escape behavior. You're getting shocked, or something aversive is happening. For dogs here, right? Solomon Wynn's dog. The dogs are getting shocked. They leave and go to the other side. So the shock, the aversive stimulus, is removed, and over trials, they do this sooner, right? So initially, you know, it's like, oh, they're getting shocked. Oh, what's going on? Finally, just accidentally, they step over to the other side, and hey, they're not getting shocked. After repeated, so trial and error, right? After repeated presentations, it's like, oh, there's a shock. Boom, straight over to the other side. So they get faster at making that escape. Okay, so aversive removed. So something's taken away. Negative behavior increases. Reinforcement. So escape, easily explained by negative reinforcement. What about avoidance, though? When avoidance happens, the dog shuttles over, that's what we mean by shuttle box, it shuttles, it moves to the other side before it gets the shock. And this behavior increases. You know, it's like, whoa, light just turned off. Oh, off I go. It's better. It gets fewer and fewer shocks. It gets better at avoidance. So the avoidance behavior is increasing, right? So you go, okay, so reinforcement. But why? Is it a positive or a negative reinforcement? An escape, the shock's taken away, so you do the behavior more, faster, better. In avoidance, you don't get the shock. I mean, there's no shock there that's being removed, and there's nothing really blatantly obvious that's being given. It's not like they give the dog little, like, insulated booties to put on so it can't be shocked. Maurer and Lamoureux in 42 said, not getting something can hardly in and of itself qualify as rewarding. So for a long time, this issue of how do we account for avoidance was a big theoretical problem. It doesn't seem like, I mean, get the reinforcement side of things, but it doesn't seem like anything's given or anything's taken away. One of the first theoretical apparent solutions to this is called the two-process theory. Two-process theory argued that to explain avoidance behavior, you need to bring both classical and operant conditioning together here. So there's both a classically conditioned component to avoidance, and then there's the operant response. So, look, if we think back when we talked about classical conditioning, lo, those many days before this, last week, we said very often, if we got a shock, we'll call that an unconditional stimulus. The pain, fear, twitch, whatever, caused by the shock, that's kind of a UR. In Solomon and Wynn's case, what precedes the shock? Well, the light bulb goes dark. So they turn the light bulb off. So darkness, that's kind of like a CS. Now, what might you postulate here as a conditional response? Maybe like fear. You know, when the light bulb goes off, it's like, oh no, shock is coming. I don't know why I think dogs talk in a wavery kind of voice like that, but I sort of assume they do. So this fits quite nicely with a classical conditioning component. US is the shock, the pain is the UR, the darkness, the light bulb getting dark is the CS, and something like fear associated with the light bulb is the CR. Now, I mean, how can we measure fear? We could, say, utilize heart rate. Maybe the dog's heart rate goes up, or its breathing increases, or it gets stomach cramps. So we use some physiological measure of fear. We don't just have to think, you know, assume, infer that they're feeling the sort of cognitive experience of fear in the same way that a human would, but we can treat this as some sort of physiological response. Now, if we go with this, then by making that avoidance response, so the light has turned off. 8 seconds from now, they're going to get shocked. The dog starts to experience fear. If it gets up and goes to the other side of the box, if it shuttles before the shock is delivered, what has it done? Well, it's removed itself from being in close proximity to the CS. It's taken the CS away. If the CS is not there, then the fear should be gone as well. So there is a response being made. The response is the shuttle. So we get the classical conditioning. So the dog learns that the CS, in this case, in Solomon's case, the dark light bulb, means that the shock is going to be delivered. And it makes the dog fearful. So there's the CR. How do we stop the fear? Go to the side where there's a light bulb that's turned on. Get away from the turned off light bulb. Get away from the CS. The dark light bulb is a CS. So go to the other side. Go to the light. Okay, that sort of thing. So what have you done? Well, you've escaped the dark light bulb. The response, that shuttling response that the dog makes, the avoidance response, is not escaping the shock. It's not nothing to do with the shock exactly. What's being taken away is the CS. You take the scary CS away, so something's removed, and the avoidance behavior increases. Negative reinforcement. So two-process theory says that escape, basic escape, you know, you're getting shocked, And so you go to the other side, shock's taken away, you do this more. So that basic escape is a case of you're just an operant response. You're getting away from the painful shock. Response leads to an outcome where the shock is taken away. In the case of avoidance, it says what you're essentially doing is you're removing yourself from the scary conditional stimulus that indicates the aversive thing is coming. So again, it's escape. So they're both instances of escape, except in the case of avoidance, you have to have a classically conditioned component first, then you make the operant response. In the case of just basic escape, you're just making an operant response. No classical conditioning. Okay. So, it makes sense. I mean, like, all right, that I can wrap my noodle around that one. But let's see, any empirical support for this? Study by Roscorla, same guy from Roscorla-Wagner equation. Roscorla and Lolordo, 65, put dogs in shuttle boxes. Now, in this case, no signal was given here, so during their initial training. But if the dog would shuttle to the other side, it would get some safe time. It would get a period in which it would not receive a shock. Okay, so a period in which it was safe. Okay. Then what they did, take the dog out of the operant chamber, take the dog out of the shuttle box, and just do standard, traditional, old-fashioned, Pavlov-style classical conditioning. Okay, so now they just did a tone paired with a shock. So, beep, zap, beep, zap. The dog can't escape, the dog can't avoid, the dog just beep, zap. Okay? Old-fashioned classical conditioning. CS tone paired with US shock. Okay. Put the dog back into the shuttle box. Okay, now remember, the dog has learned that there's no signal, there's no stimulus telling it when the shock is coming, but it's learned that if it just, you know, like makes a, if it goes to the other side of the box, it gets 30 seconds of safety. And so what we find is our dog here, roughly every 25 seconds or so, gets up, goes to the other side of the box, and they get very good at this. They tend to avoid getting any shocks because they just keep going back and forth. Back and forth. Every time they shuttle over, another 30 seconds of safety. So they go back to doing that. Then, so the dog has just shuttled. It's just done its shuttle. We would expect it's going to wait about another 25 seconds or so before it starts to make its next shuttle. Beep! They turn the tone on. Remember, the tone is a classically conditional stimulus for shock. So, beep! The dog gets up and goes to the other side. Should have another 25 seconds of safety, 30 seconds of safety here. Shouldn't start making its next shuttle for another 25 seconds because it just shuttled. Tone on. Tone is a CS for shock. Tone says shock's coming. What do? If you know the shock is coming, you leave. Go to the other side. So what this is saying here is by now putting a conditional stimulus into this situation, this can increase the avoidance behavior. So that's support for the two-process theory, the idea that a classically conditioned component can influence this operant response, this shuttling response. Incidentally, if we do a conditioned inhibition, so a CS minus, so we could say train up a light so that now, you know, if tone means shock, light means no shock. So you could have a dog that is, say, shuttle that's been sitting there for 25 seconds. It's about to get up and go, but you turn on the light. If it's learned, oh, light means no shock, it'll just sit back down and wait for a while before it does its next shuttle. So again, in both cases, you know, an excitatory conditional stimulus says, yeah, shock's coming, go. An inhibitory conditional stimulus says, no shock's going to happen this time. You can just hang out. So classical conditioning can influence an operant response. Lovely. Brilliant. But two-process theory's not out of the woods yet. There are some problems with it. First off, the more experience dogs, cats, people get with making avoidance responses, the better they get at it, the less they seem to be afraid. You know, ever phoned in sick for work when you weren't sick? Right? Don't tell me. I don't really need to know. But you know, I mean, first time you ever tried to play hooky from work or something, it's like, oh, I got caught. Yeah. But if you get good at it, so yeah, don't worry about it. I'm just gonna phone in sick. Yeah, they're not gonna catch me. I'm good at this. Hello. Yeah. Okay. I've got avian flu. I don't think I should be working today in the restaurant. Probably a good idea. Okay, stay home. Funny, you seem to get avian flu a lot. Well, I know. All the chickens I have here in my house. Repeating Thorndike's experiments. Okay. So whatever. But physiologically, say just something like heart rate, right? Not very consistent. I mean, we find that in many cases with dogs, you know, the better they get at making avoidance, their heart rate doesn't go up when the CS is presented. Matter of fact, if you actually watch case for these kind of avoidance responses in the shuttle box, the animals kind of get a bit blasé, right? You know, it's like, lights off, yeah, shock coming in 8 seconds, dog gets up, stretches, crack, 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 goes over to the other side, does the thing the dogs do, turn around 3 times, back down. It's like, yes, the dog looked just terrified of the dark light bulb. Yeah. Like, it's not, okay? So, we have a problem here. It seems that fear is diminishing. Now, that's a very sort of, you know, anecdotal kind of measure. Just, well, the dog doesn't look scared. Okay, so maybe we need something a little bit more concrete. Intercayman, Brimmer, and Black, the study in 1963. They trained rats, in this case, not dogs, rats, to press a lever for food. Okay, so they got rats doing the lever pressing for food thing. Then they shift to a shuttle box. No lever here. They're into the shuttle box. They use an auditory CS. So in the presence of a tone, you're going to get a shock. But if you avoid, while the tone is sounding, if you hop to the other side of the box, no shock. Now, they trained. They had 4 groups of rats. First group, they trained until the rat had made one successful avoidance response. So the very first time they successfully avoid, boom, done. Training done. Second group of rats have to do 3 in a row. Now, that doesn't mean they just do 3 successful avoidance responses, because they might do 1 avoidance response, oh, but the next one they screw up and they get shocked, they don't avoid in time, then maybe they do another one, they get shocked again, then they get a couple in a row. So they got to go until they get 3 in a row. So they may have done way more than three avoidance learnings. Group 9 has to do 9 in a row. Group 27 in a row. I mean, if you get up to like 24 and you get shocked, you're starting over again. So our group 27 rats have had hundreds and hundreds of learning trials. They have a lot of experience with this. They take the rats, put them back into the operant chamber where they can start pressing the lever for food, and they do the periodic suppression ratio test. Let's turn the tone on and see whether or not the rat freezes, therefore stops pressing the lever, so whether the lever pressing decreases during the conditional stimulus. Here's what they get. Group 1 rats, not a lot of suppression, right? The responding stays high during the tone. And, you know, that makes sense. They've only successfully done a single avoidance response. They really haven't learned very much here. We would expect things to be a little more suppressed with our higher groups. And sure enough, this looks good for group 3. Oh, here we go. Group 3 rats have gotten this idea that in the presence of the tone means you're going to get the shock there, so they suppress. Now, we would expect, if tuberose is correct, if the CS is producing fear and you're avoiding because of the fear, what we would expect is that for group 9 and 27, we would have even more suppression. But we don't. Group 9 rats suppress less than group 3, and the group 27 rats, heck, they're really not suppressing, they're responding at all. I mean, they're responding even more than the group 1 rats. They really didn't learn anything. The group 27 rats are the ones that have learned this classical conditioning better than any others. If two-process theory is right, these should be the ones that are really scared of the tone, really scared of the CS. But they're not. They're the least scared. They suppress the responding the least. It seems that what's happened here is, like, groups 9 and group 27 rats have learned, you know what? I'm pretty good at avoiding. Yeah, yeah, the CS means a shock is coming, but, you know, I'm good at not getting shocked. Once you get good at something, you don't tend to worry about it too much. Right? If you're good at taking exams, not the biggest fear you got. If you're good at writing papers, if you're good at cutting out on work, you know, by coming up with a lie to get out of it, you're not that worried about it. That's what this indicates. It says, yeah, the better you get at avoiding, the less afraid you are. You know that you're not going to get off. The more zombies you've killed in zombie apocalypse, the less worried you're going to be about them because you're good at killing zombies. By this point, you know, seriously, in Walking Dead, you'd think everyone's like, oh, yeah, zombie. Yeah, there's another one. Ah, I'll take this one. Yeah. Beep in the eyes, you know. Yeah. That's possible, yeah. It's going to be a contextual stimulus. So do they learn, it's like, oh, I only get the shock in the operant chamber, or pardon me, in the shuttlebox chamber, not the operant. Excellent point. Yes, that's a possibility. So what's the solution? Well, you can do that too. So basically make your operant chamber and your shuttlebox the same thing. So put the lever into the shuttle chamber as well, or make it as similar as possible. So, yeah, but that's a good point. So one would do controls on that, and in fact, there have been additional controls. But, yeah, that's an excellent point. But if that was sort of really the case as well, we wouldn't expect this kind of behavior for group three either, because they seem to transfer it there. So, yeah. But, yep. I haven't told you all the controls that went into this. The two process theorists come back with, it's like, oh yeah, well, maybe the rats are just a little bit afraid and that's enough. Really? That's the best you got? They're just a teeny bit afraid? And that's why they avoid? Ew, kind of weak dudes. Here's a big problem. Okay. Remember you said your theory has to support your data? If your theory and your data don't match, problem. I call this the yo-yo effect. Okay. This is a prediction that comes out of the two-process theory. Okay, direct prediction out of the theory of what behavior we should see. What we should see is the avoidance behavior should toggle or go up and down like a yo-yo. But we don't. Okay. So here's why things should happen. Here's why we should get the yo-yo effect. I put successful avoidance in red, number of unconditional stimuli received in blue, and trials along the x-axis here. So as a rat experiences or a dog or whatever experiences a number of trials here, they're going to get better at avoiding, right? So the more avoidance responses you make, the fewer unconditional stimuli, the fewer shocks you're going to receive, right? Can we agree on that? I mean, it's probably not straight lines. It's probably more some sort of curve, sinusoid motion, but I've just drawn straight lines here, right? The idea, basically. So the better you get at avoiding, the fewer shocks you receive. Now, think back to classical conditioning. What happens when the CS is no longer followed by the US? Extinction, thank you. Yes, there's an exam coming up. I was a little worried there. Yes, extinction. It's called extinction. Okay, now according to two-process theory, what are you actually getting away from? You're getting away from the CS. It's not the shock you're getting away from. It's the conditional stimulus that you flee from, because that's what's scary. Well, if we've been extinguishing the CS, we would expect then that our fear is going to get less. If our fear gets less, we would expect that the subject is going to make fewer avoidance responses because they're no longer afraid. But if you make fewer avoidance responses, you're going to start getting more shocks. Right? Because if you don't avoid in time, you get shocked. Ah, okay, so now the CS is being followed by the US again. That puts us back onto acquisition. So what we'd expect now is the conditional response of fear is going to start getting stronger and stronger. So then we would expect to make more avoidance responses. And if you make more avoidance responses, you get fewer shocks. If fewer shocks, you're on extinction, the CR weakens, you should make fewer avoidance responses, you should get more shocks, the CR should strengthen again. So two-process theory, this is just coming out of the theory, says we should get this toggling behavior. Subjects should avoid a lot, then start avoiding less, then start avoiding a lot, and they start getting the aversive again, and back and forth. We don't see this. Once subjects learn to avoid, stunningly persistent. You can even turn the switch for the shock delivery system off. It's like, yep, new shock's happening. They'll just keep doing it. If they have no way of telling that they're not going to get shocked, just keep shuttling. Okay. So we got some problems with the two process. Alternate theory. One process theory. One process theory says, hey, you know what? We don't actually need the classical conditioning component here at all. We actually can explain this just with operant conditioning. Now, there's two ways this can be done. We can talk about what are called molar interpretations and molecular interpretations. Molar theories, molar interpretations deal with large-scale things. Think of, like, the molars in your mouth, the big teeth, okay? Molecular interpretations deal with stuff on the small scale, like the molecules that make up your teeth, or just the idea of molecules, teeny, okay? But what we mean here is like maybe trial by trial or individual events. All right, now, your textbook talks about this in terms of negative reinforcement. This is a molar interpretation. Here's the idea. If instead of looking at this on each trial, if our subject is able to sort of keep a long-run average going, it's like, okay, in the last half hour, how many shocks have I gotten? If they start making avoidance responses, right? We said the problem with avoidance from theory point of view is there's nothing obviously taken away or delivered. You see that it's a reinforcement, but is it positive or negative? If you're able to sort of keep a long-term average running, say, okay, for the first half hour, I started doing this and I got a lot of shocks. Then, next half hour, I started doing some avoidance here and I got fewer shocks. I got less shocks than I did in the first half hour. And so I did a few more avoidance respondings in the next half hour and I got even less comparing it to the earlier time period. So, from the molar perspective, so not on an individual trial. On an individual trial, the subject either gets shocked or it doesn't. But over the long run, if avoidance reduces the overall number of shocks received, what's been taken away? Well, a bunch of the shocks. The overall number of shocks has gone down. Okay, so negative reinforcement. So that's a molar interpretation of one process theory that says we can do it just with operant conditioning principles. Second way that we can look at this is as a case of positive reinforcement. This one says, and this is our molecular interpretation, it says on any particular trial, so if you make an avoidance response, the avoidance in and of itself is the reinforcer. So on this trial, so you make an avoidance response, what do you get? You get safety. You get to not be shocked. If you don't make the avoidance response, you get shocked. If you do make it, you get safety. You get the get out of jail free card. Okay. So what's been delivered? Brief period of safety. Positive reinforcement. Okay. You can even make this more pronounced by making the two sides of the shuttle box really blatantly different. Makes it easier. So it's like, if I'm going to get shocked on this side that's painted all like white, but if I go over to the dark side, the black side, and I don't get shocked, makes it easier. Or pink or green or whatever, you know, painted some other color, this makes it even easier. It's like, oh yeah, if I go to the green side, I'm safe. Or the black side or the orange side, whatever color you want to paint it. Good diagonal stripes, I don't care. Makes it even easier. So you make it distinctive. It's like, oh yeah, I got something. I got safety in this trial. Okay. So say, okay, that's nice. Seems good. And two-process theory seemed good, and we had some problems there, so what do we got? Technique called Sidman's avoidance task. In Sidman's avoidance task, it's a free operant avoidance process. And what Sidman was asking was, can subjects learn to avoid if there is no conditional stimulus? According to the two-process theory, they shouldn't be able to. According to the two-process theory, there needs to be a conditional stimulus, right? Because you need to have classical conditioning in there. So Sidman just gave shocks at random times. If his rats, he liked working with rats. Some people like pigeons, some like dogs, some like rats. Sidman liked rats. If the rats made a lever press, a response, they would get a period of safety. Now, what Sidman found was that this was really kind of tough for his rats. Some of the rats never really got it very well. It took them, most of them did. Most of them were able to start making these avoidance responses and got, but they still got some shocks. He found it's a lot easier for the rats to do it if you do give them a stimulus that says, hey, shock's coming. But he found that even if you don't, they can do it. They're usually never perfect, and there's a lot of variability. Some of the rats seem pretty just like, I don't understand what's going on. Others are like, oh yeah, the lever, if I press it, I get, okay. Right, so not easy, but definitely do it. Now, he gave them set periods of safe time, like 20 seconds of safety. So fine, as the rats would keep pressing roughly, you know, every 20 seconds or so. Two-processed theorist supporters said, here you go. Yeah, it's the time. So that safety period, that becomes a conditional stimulus. Because rats can tell time, sort of. Up to a point. So that's the CS. As the clock ticks down on safety, they get afraid. So the time elicits fear. Okay, fine. So we could do this with like a random amount of safety time. He does it that way, and then he finds that the rats just, you know, tend to press the lever fairly frequently. So seems that we do not need a conditional stimulus to learn avoidance. Hernstein and Heinlein, 66, did a study. In this case here, what they had was, you were going to get shocked, but you're either going to get shocked rapidly or slowly. So you're going to get a lot of shocks or fewer shocks. You're not going to get no shocks. Making a response would switch from the high shock schedule to the low shock schedule. Say that five times fast. Okay, so you still get shocked, but you don't get shocked as much. Now, the shocks are presented randomly. There's no signal, and there's no consistent time on how long. So if you're on the high, you press the lever, you get moved to the low. At some random point, you get popped back to the high again. So there's no consistent way you can use time to make a prediction about how long are you going to be in the low. So our timing here can't become a conditional stimulus. All that happens is once you realize you're back on the high schedule, boom, press the lever again. So, again, there's no obvious CS here. What seems to be reinforcing, and here's another one, this is kind of like, this is a molar example, the one process. The overall reduction in shock frequency, that's the reinforcer. What gets taken away? Number of shocks you're getting fits with the one process interpretation. Okay. Now, one of the interesting things that we can get into with things like escape and avoidance or the lack thereof, the lack of the ability to do this, is something that's called learned helplessness. Learned helplessness occurs when an individual finds that his or her behavior has no effect on the situation. That's a problem. In and of itself, that's a problem. So if you've got, say, a hypothetical school kid who feels that he's doing, just doesn't get math, right? Might stop doing the homework in math. I just can't do math. Can't do math. I suck at math. I can't do math. Okay, so you've got some learned helplessness in math, right? Anything, I tried studying, I tried going to the teacher for help, I just can't get it. I can't do math. Okay, so we've got some learned helplessness there. So what's happening is, have you tried, like, really studying? Yes, it doesn't work. Okay. So they kind of quit. That's bad. What's worse with this is learned helplessness generalizes easily. So once it's like, I can't do math, it starts to spread. I can't do science, I can't do English, I just can't do school. I'm just not smart. Okay? So this becomes a problem. Or, bad relationship, I can't do this relationship, it's not working, it's bad, it's horrible, I can't do any relationships. Whether it's a romantic relationship or relationships with family members or just people in the work that you're where you're working, anything. So it can generalize. Now, in a laboratory setting, we can induce learned helplessness, give subjects a series of inescapable shocks. Put a collar on them, tie them down, whatever, put them in a box where they can't get out, zap, 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 zap. Inescapable shocks. Put them into the shuttle box. Now, in the shuttle box, they could shuttle, they could escape, they could avoid. They don't. Why? What have they learned? That first phase has taught them, there's nothing I can do. There is. Context has changed. There is. Like, yeah, I don't think so. Okay? Learned helplessness. The subject in this first phase with the inescapable shocks has learned an expectation that behavior will have no effect. In humans, see this as depression. Okay? Everybody experiences some short-term depression over specific things. That's standard. We get into problems when it becomes longer-term, full-blown clinical depression. And typically, this comes about when people feel that situations are running beyond their control. There are three factors that therapists, researchers typically talk about in terms of depression, so three dimensions. The situation. Is it specific or global? So is it the child just thinks they can't do math, or is it they can't do any schoolwork? In terms of treatment, specific is easier to treat than global. Once it's moved on to, all other things being equal, right? There's always variables, but all other things being equal, it's going to be easier to treat a specific case of learned helplessness or depression than a global case. And use different techniques depending on what you're treating here. Attribution, internal or external, sometimes also called internal or external locus of control. I can't do math because I just don't get math. I suck at math. I'm stupid at math. That's an internal locus of control. External. I can't do math because the teacher doesn't like me and all the other kids have got better calculators. External locus of control. I know, it sounds funny, but you get this. I can't do it because the world is against me. Very real. Therapists deal with this all the time. Okay? One isn't necessarily easier than the other to deal with, but you have to identify what attribution state you've got because the techniques for treatment will vary. Okay. Finally, the time course. Is this a short-term problem or a long-term problem? Obviously, it's easier to deal with short-term situations than long-term. The longer it's been going on, the more conditioned the behaviors become, the harder it's going to be to alter. So, if nothing else, this is a real call for why we should have more actual education clinical counselors in schools, not like the, you might think about doing this for a job in future. Not that kind of counselor, but counselors that are specifically trained in early childhood clinical situations so they can recognize these cases early and start therapy early on. Okay, how do you actually implement some therapies with respect to this? There's various ways. I'm going to deal actually the second one here first. Tasks that can be successfully completed. This is called immunization. So if you put the dog in the shuttle box first and it learns avoidance, so it's learned I can avoid. Then you take and chain it up and give it shock, 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 inescapable shock. Put it back in the shuttle box, it goes back to shuttling. If you will, the initial learning that you can be successful, that your behavior can have a control on the environment, that, quote unquote, immunizes you. So then when you get into the inescapable situation, you've already learned, oh, there's stuff I can do. I can't do it right now. It's not working now, but in other cases, it works. So you get put into a new situation. You can still do the avoidance. Learned helplessness is less likely to occur. People like Siegelman said, we need to start immunization in, say, school kids right away. Kindergarten, now preschool, okay? So instead of giving them something, if they can't do it, if you give them a question, assignment, a task, whatever they're having problems with, step it down. Give them something they can do. Immunize them. It's like, hey, this is hard, but you can do it. We'll give you the skills to do it. If you just let them flounder, it's going to get worse and worse and worse. Back in my day, kids could actually be failed in, like, elementary school, junior high. Here, I don't know what it's like in other places, but in Edmonton, a junior high school teacher, a good friend of mine is a junior high school teacher, he can't actually fail one of his students. He can say, I recommend that this student be held back for a year, and then it's up to the parents to decide what is done. It's not up to the educators who are trained in this. He cannot give failing grades. He's not allowed to. So what happens? You get a kid that, for whatever reason, could be external factors, who knows what, you know, parents going through divorce, could be anything, got sick during that year, whatever it is, and just gets passed. The more you get passed, the worse you're doing, because you're further and further behind. Where do we think this is going? Okay. But if we set things up early, we make sure, okay, it's like, fine, you know what, yeah, this has been a bad year for you. It's just, this is not working well for you. Let's go back. Let's do some of this over. Let's give you the skills to succeed. Boom, move on. You'll be okay then. Set that up. This is proactive. You have to do this in advance. Okay? Hey, here's a simple one. You go into the bookstore. You're checking out courses to take or whatnot. Most people are right-handed. So most people, if you're going to say, I wonder what this text is about, pick up the text. Typically, right-handed people will hold the text in the right hand, dominant hand. Pick it up. Oh, yeah. Flip through it. So you're starting to blip, 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 blip from the back of the book, right? Let's say you picked up a calculus book. Oh, calculus thing. Let's try a calculus. Pick it up, look at the back. Oh, yeah, I have no idea what this stuff is, right? There's crazy symbols and squiggles and lines. And so it's like, oh, yeah, they're huge. The whole page is no letters. Well, there is letters, but they're in equations. There's no words. Can't do that. Pick it up in the left hand. Chapter 1. The addition sign. Multiplication. That's good. Hey, oh, there's a new squiggle. It's kind of like a long S. Differential equations. I said, it's getting more of them. Oh, that makes sense. I'm in chapter 20 now. Okay. Go from the front to the back. Start with the simple stuff. Progress. Okay. Immunization. That's what's called confidence building. Or sometimes called cannot fail therapy. The idea is you're supposed to give individuals cases where they just can't fail, okay? That they can succeed, builds confidence. In theory, and this can be applied to individuals that are already at some point in learned helplessness. In theory, this seems simple. In practice, this is actually very difficult to implement. Got the kid that's having problems with math, you know, you're in the classroom, go up to the whiteboard, Bill, do 109 divided by 6. Susan, do 15.5 times 3.2. John, you know, our one who's learned helps, do 2 times 3. What do you got now? It's like, wow. Even the teacher thinks I'm incompetent. I'm being given baby stuff to do. You should be able to do 2 times 3, but that's not going to build confidence. That's just going to reinforce the idea that really isn't competent. Very, very difficult to implement this successfully. Okay? Back when I was a kid, our school, every school has somebody like this in the grade, right? But and just going back in time, kids are not nice, okay? No surprise there. Kids are nice. But a guy, I'll call him Kenneth because that was, in fact, his name. Kenneth was kind of the utter spastic in the class, right? You know, smart, brainy, I hope Kenneth has done well. I hope he's like gone into IT and made tons of money. That'd be great. But I mean, he just was the weird kid. Okay? Mm-hmm. And just, Mr. Chom, our social studies and phys ed teacher, in retrospect, I now understand what I think he was doing. So Mr. Chom felt that, if it was raining, we'd be inside, we'd do dodgeball. If we were outside, we'd be running laps. This was phys ed in the early 1970s. Anyways, so it's like, now, I mean, Kenneth, just running laps, he'd like fall down standing still. So he's always like staggering along, tripping behind the rest of the group. And one day Chom said, we're out for outside, and it's like, you know what we're doing today? My friend Brad, who was very athletic and a little bit keen, is like, running laps. It's like, that's right. Kenneth, go stand over there. Kenneth stumbles over, stands there, and it's like, the rest of you, says Mr. Chom to us, let Kenneth win. What? Let him be first. He's going to run in front. My friend Brad, aforementioned athletic guy, is like, Mr. Chom, Kenneth's a total spastic. Let him win. Okay. So, Kenneth, get back over here. Run. No, stand there. Because Kenneth's not running. Kenneth's not stupid. Just a bit weird, in other words, but not particularly physically inclined. But he knows he's not going to be in front. He knows he's always going to be stumbling along. So why start running and have everyone else like stampede over him? He's going to wait for everyone to run around him, and then he's going to... I think at this point, Mr. Chom had the first inkling that maybe things weren't going to work particularly well here. It's like, Kenneth, run! It's like, off he goes, and the rest of us just kind of shuffle along behind. And my friend Brad, maybe trying to, make up for the spastic comment. It's like, Kenneth! He was on a lot of sports teams, so coaches and encouragement and crap like that. But it's like, you're so fast, Kenneth! I can't keep up! That's stupid. So Kenneth slows down, and we all slow down. He shuffles up a little faster. We shuffle up a little faster. Kenneth stops. We all stop. Some of us are like faking panting, sort of thing, exhausted. So Kenneth then starts walking backwards, and in a panic, the rest of us just all sort of shuffle backwards. At that point, we got taken inside into dodgeball. In retrospect, he was trying to implement a cannot fail technique to give confidence. Dismal, dismal failure. Okay, didn't work. It's hard to implement, okay? Which is why you should be trained before you try this stuff yourself. Let's finish up by talking about some theories of classical conditioning. We mentioned that Thorndike thought it was, about the stimulus response component. That's what was most important here. But here's some other things. One of the big questions that sort of comes up in operant conditioning theory is, how can we tell beforehand, or what predictions can we make beforehand as to whether something's going to be a reinforcer or a punisher, whether something's going to be an appetitive, lead to an appetitive outcome, whether it's going to be aversive. How can we predict that? Because it'd be nice to know in advance, right? Okay, Clark Hull, Canadian, actually. Said, look, physiologically, we know this. Animals have, including humans, have these motivational states. We've talked about the drives. Okay, we've talked about these as drives. Regulatory drives are things that are necessary for survival. So access to food, water, warmth, if you're a mammal. These are the sort of regulatory drives. So Clark postulated that reinforcers are going to be things that are going to reduce a drive. If you are hungry, you eat. By eating, you reduce this hunger drive. And you've got the hunger drive because your body needs caloric intake to be able to keep functioning. Okay? So if you're thirsty, you drink. Okay? These sorts of things. He says it's about the physiological value. So if you can reduce this physiological state, if you can bring it back closer to homeostasis, reinforcement. Things that take you away from your homeostatic state, those we will predict are going to be punishers. Okay, nice, elegant, simple, straightforward. Works pretty well with most primary reinforcers. Okay? So with most of the primary reinforcers, Hall's drive reduction interpretation score doesn't work well with, or doesn't directly work with secondaries, right? Because most secondary reinforcers have no actual physiological value whatsoever. Hall said, I know that. I know that. But remember, there's an association being made, right? In a secondary reinforcer, it's been associated with the primary. So, okay, it's still linking into that primary. Okay. But Clark, it's some of these reinforcers are a little hard to classify as a primary or secondary. It's, well, whatever do you mean? It's like, some things actually increase physiological states, actually pull them away from homeostasis. And some of the stuff your body actually needs to survive, you can't actually really detect it. That's a bit of a problem there. So consider roller coasters. You know, who likes roller coasters? Yeah. What, a really good roller coaster is the one that makes you think you are going to die, right? I mean, you know, it's not the little kids when. Good roller coasters are the good roller coasters are the ones that people have died on, right? Yeah, it's like okay, no, not right. Those are horrible. but I mean, you think I heard that an entire train of people on this roller coaster all died of heart attacks on it, right? I mean, those like the urban legends of this is the Widowmaker. Okay, those are the roller coasters. You come off it, and it's like your blood pressure is screaming, and your body is just, let's go again. Okay, do you think that person is actually in a balanced homeostatic state? I would say no. All right. Heart rate, 212. Do it again. Stunning. I mean, not everybody likes these, right? But I mean, stunningly reinforcing. They will go back and do the ride again and again and again until the heart actually explodes. Well, not really, okay. But is that taking you away from your physiological state? Your homeostasis? Hells yeah. Okay. So there's a little problem there. Vitamins. You need certain vitamins. Tell me, what does vitamin D taste like? Look like? Yeah, it tastes like sunshine. Okay. What's that like? It tastes dry and my tongue flying out. Yeah, vitamin D tastes like sunshine. That's great. Okay, so I'll blindfold you. It's like, okay, can you taste the radiation? Can you taste it? Vitamin A then. What's vitamin A taste like? Yeah, exactly. You can't detect these, you know? It's like, it seems like the kind of thing that some villain, you know, in like a Bond movie, is like, Mr. Bond, I've depleted your body of vitamin A. Before you are five piles of powder. Your only chance for surviving is to actually find the vitamin A. Yeah, stupid, right? But I mean, sure, your body gets cravings for certain foods, like, you know, if you're probably low in potassium and suddenly, I think I need to eat a banana, which for me is a big thing because I really don't like bananas unless there's like a whole bunch of ice cream and chocolate sauce, whipped cream, and a cherry on it. But, you know, my kids, this boggles their brains. Like, but we all like bananas. Why don't you? What's wrong with you? It's like, I just don't like the taste of it. You don't like peppers, you know? It's like because the skins get caught in my throat and I throw up. Okay, fine. You've got a reason. It's like, I just, you know, but if you suddenly start craving bananas, you think, I bet I'm a little bit potassium depleted. But that's a food association. You've come to associate your body's, categorize this. This is a food that probably has the, you can't just tell. You know, it's like, hey, what's the potassium pill on the table? Which one is that? No way of knowing. But you need that stuff, right? Saccharin. No caloric value in saccharin. Rats will, like, run themselves practically to death in a chance to get saccharin. It tastes sweet. If it tastes sweet, it must be high caloric value, right? No. Not as it turns out. Okay, so we got some problems with Hull's drive reduction here. Second theory here, called the relative value theory, or commonly called the Premack principle, after Premack, who did a lot of research on this. Premack said, look, what we should do here is we need to get away from this thinking about things as responses and outcomes, reinforcers or punishment being different from the responses, which is a behavior. He said, we just need to treat, let's just deal with reinforcers for now. Let's just treat the reinforcer as a behavior. So is it the food that's the reinforcer? Or is it the behavior of eating the food? Thank you for taking part in this study. Congratulations, you have actually gotten this candy bar. Oh, it's excellent, I'm starving. Whoa, 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 whoa. You're not going to eat that, are you? Yeah, you gave me the candy. Oh, no, I didn't say you could eat the candy bar. I just gave you the candy bar. You just keep that. You can't actually eat it. What use is that? Is it having the food that's the reinforcer or eating the food that's the reinforcer? Premack would say it's probably, unless you're weird and you just like hoard food. It's like, all right, can of cranberries, yeah. It's probably eating the food that's the reinforcer here, right? You know, I mean, people are weird about this, but it's like give this like, here you go, you know, Daisy, one of my dogs. Here's the can of dog food.
Can opener?
You know, it's like kind of a Scooby-Doo thing here, but you know.
Yeah.
Okay, so he says, look, what we do is we need to generate a behavioral probability scale. It says some behaviors are going to be high probability, some behaviors are going to be low probability. It'll be greater or lesser values of behaviors relative to one another on this scale. And when we do this, he says there's no real distinction then between a primary and a secondary reinforcer. Everything's just a behavior. So if we're able to observe individuals and categorize the behavior responses they make, we should be able to generate a probability scale, saying this is a really high probability behavior for this individual, this is a low probability behavior for this individual. And different individuals will have different scales, right? Some people really like keeping their house clean. Other people don't really mind the clutter that much. It's amazing my wife and I are still together. High probability behaviors, Premack says, will serve to reinforce low probability behaviors. In other words, being given, if you do the low probability behavior, and that gets you the high probability behavior, you will do the low probability behavior more. It will be increased. You got to set the contingency up. The only way you get the high probability behavior is by doing this low probability behavior. Okay, so we set up the contingency. Here it says, generate a probability, a baseline probability scale. So the easiest way to do this, different ways to do it, but he said the easiest way is just observe your subjects for some period of time, like an hour, a half hour, whatever. Watch everything they do. Record the amount of time they spend on it. So the probability response is going to be the time spent on the response divided by the total time you've been observing them. It says, rank order them from least probable to most probable. There's your scale. Now, there's no absolutes here. All behaviors are going to be relative to one another. Okay? Whatever the highest probability behavior it is you've observed, there may be something else that's even higher. You just haven't seen it. And, you know, it's less reinforcing compared to the second highest probability and more reinforcing compared to the lowest probability behavior. Okay, so there's no real absolutes here. Let's take a little example quickly. Let's say we're doing something with some kids. We've got three things we can use here for reinforcers: eat ice cream, play video games, or read a book. We'll observe them for 30 minutes. Student one eats ice cream for 2 minutes, plays video games for 8 minutes, and reads books for 20 minutes. So on the probability scale of least to most, least likely behavior, ice cream eating, then video games, most likely book reading. Student two eats ice cream for 8 minutes, plays video games for 20 minutes, reads books for 2 minutes. Different scale here, least probable book reading, then ice cream eating, then video game playing is the most probable. So if we want to set up reinforcement contingencies for student one, video game playing can serve as a reinforcer for ice cream. Okay. And book reading can serve as a reinforcer for both ice cream and video game playing. Now, why exactly do we want the kid to eat more ice cream, I don't know. It's like, you know, you're just not fat enough. Eat more. I don't want to eat more. Well, if you eat some more ice cream, we'll let you play with the video game. Okay. Student two, ice cream acts as a reinforcer for book reading, and video game playing acts as a reinforcer for both of those because it's a higher probability behavior. Okay. Now, people have raised some issues with pre-max approach here. What are your baseline phase? Right? I mean, are you getting really a fair rating system by doing this? I mean, you know, like in the example I gave, video game playing, book reading, ice cream eating, you know, these are kind of categorically different behaviors, right? So, I mean, you know, in like 1 minute, you can probably eat a lot of ice cream. But, I mean, how far can you get in the video game? Right? And, you know, whatever, Grand Theft Auto. And you've gotten into the car, you just pulled out of the parking lot, and oh, game's over. Yeah, that was stunningly satisfying. Didn't get to run anything off the road or shoot anything yet? Yay. Premix said, yeah, I know. In theory, though, this works, right? In principle, yeah. And he says, look, you know, you don't have to do the time thing if you don't want. You can come up with something more complicated, be my guest. PMAC is really interested in applications, especially in things like education and like penal systems and whatnot. So he said, look, you know what? You want to do something more complicated? Go ahead. But honestly, the time measure baseline observed for 30 minutes, an hour, whatever, it's pretty simple. He said, sure, I know. What if time isn't particularly important to a behavior? That's an issue. Sure. Okay, no problem. Behavioral duration. I mean, how long should you really look at? Based on, I've actually been doing a behavioral measurement of you guys all class. As far as I can tell, not one of you has gone to Hawaii on a vacation during this class. Based upon that, my conclusion is going to Hawaii would not be a good reinforcer for you. I was thinking of offering this as a reward for whoever does best in the class, but my observation of you has said it's not going to work. So, similarly, none of you have actually slept during the class today. So apparently you don't actually like sleep either. Weird. Surprised. Okay. All right. So he says, yeah, sure, that's an issue. But he says, in principle, these are not deal breakers. The idea of the relative value works. Okay. Response deprivation theory. This one says, deprived behaviors are going to be reinforcing behaviors. If you deprive an individual, so think we talked about like food deprivation, dropping down 80% free feeding weight. If you deprive an individual of being able to engage in a behavior, do that long enough, they say at some point you're going to drop below a baseline, quote unquote, homeostatic level, behavioral homeostasis level. You'll drop below this baseline level of performance, and then you'll want to be doing this. You've been deprived, right? I don't mind a certain amount of clutter in my house or my life, you know, having my stuff around me is comforting. But even, you know, if I have not been allowed to straighten certain things up, given, yeah, because that kind of thing happens, I keep knocking things over, and it could kill me, you know, or something like that. You okay? At some point, deprive me of this, like, you're not allowed to straighten things up. Really? Okay, cool. Oh, I'm having a hard time finding myself. Oh, you still can't straighten up. Really? I'm losing stuff for the course I'm teaching, and it's like, at some point, I'm going to feel like I have to, you know, sneak out in the middle of the night to clean up. Okay, so at some point. The difference here is it's not about the relative frequency of one behavior compared to the other, like in pre-max. So we're not dealing with a behavioral scale here. It's the level of deprivation for a behavior. So what this is saying is the response deprivation theory says that the reinforcing value of behavior is going to either go up or down depending upon satiation deprivation levels. So it's going to be very flexible and toggly. So if you have not eaten for a day, food is probably going to be highly reinforcing. But once you've gone to buffet world, all you can eat, and you ate it all, you're going to get your $13.97's worth out of it, you know. Once you've done that, yeah, food's probably not all that reinforcing for you. So it went from being a very high reinforcer to plummeted down to the bottom. And then we'll gradually come back up again. Okay? So it's the level of deprivation here that's going to be important. Okay, so we have a midterm on Tuesday. Fancy that. There are sample questions up on the exam. So if you go to the course evaluation, okay, so if you go to the main page, course evaluation, down there, exams. Okay, bottom one here. Here's exam, tells the information. Down at the bottom here, midterm sample questions. Take that link. So I demonstrate to you that it does work. There's a bunch of sample questions. Okay? So the midterm is going to be 75 questions. They're multiple choice. There's nothing that is intentionally a trick. If you think, oh, here's a trick question, it's not. It may be difficult. It may make you think. Look at it again. Okay? There will be questions that deal with application, questions that deal with can you pull things together. There will be questions with, do you remember what this term is? Because some of this you just need to learn some terminology if you're going to work in the field. Okay? There are a few questions that are like, you know, here's a little situation. Answer the next few questions based upon this information. So, you know, multi-part, I guess, if you will. Four answer, multiple choice. Okay. For the people that are writing at SSDS, I will get your exams sent over to SSDS, and they will handle that with you. Everyone else, be here. The exam will start at the beginning of class. We'll pass it out. You'll have an hour and a half, 90 minutes to do the exam. We'll then take, you know, about a 10-minute break, and then class will start up. I'll be doing some lecturing. So once you are done the exam, once you've turned your exam in, vamos, out you go. No just hanging out in class, right? Because you might want to be doing something else. You might make noise, whatever it is. Other people need to finish their exam. So once you're done, leave. If you want to take any of your stuff with you, take it with you. Don't come back in until the exam is over. Okay, it's just fairer for everybody, okay? I know I sound like a hard ass on this, but it's just nicer for everyone else. Please no food. I don't really care if you're drinking water or, you know, coffee or you know, whatever. You dissolve your heroin into your coffee or whatever it is that you have to do to get through this. But no. But please no, it's like crinkle, 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 crinkle. Crinkle, crinkle. Okay, because I've had that happen. HB pencil. I'll have some crappy pencils, you know, the little golf pencils, because that's what they give me now. Years ago, they used to give me stuff with erasers, but that's too expensive now. So you get the crap pencil if you don't bring your own. Bring an HB pencil, eraser, that kind of thing. There are different forms of the exam. The questions are in different orders, right? So I know we're packed in here, but don't really bother looking at somebody else's. By the time you find the same question you're wondering about, you might as well have just done the other questions. If you hit a question that you don't know, don't spend 10 minutes like, circle it on the exam booklet. Come back. Do the rest of it. Come back later. Okay? Best multiple choice advice I can give you. If you don't know it, if you're spending more than a minute trying to, what is this about? Leave it. Come back later. Worst case, you just guess. Right? I'm not doing any silly right minus wrong. Okay? So worst case situation, guess you got a 25% chance of getting it right. All right. Okay. I will take your second assignments and lay them down outside like we did in the last one.